The thing about feeling tones is that, to me, what is one of the feeling tone which is very interesting is a neutral feeling one, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And there is a quote from the text, actually said by a Buddhist nun many centuries ago at the time of the Buddha. And so that's what she said about feeling tones. So first one, as long as a pleasant feeling tone continues, it's pleasant. When it stops, it can become unpleasant. So we have, that's what I was pointing out in the discussion, to be careful when there is this swift change. Like you had a very pleasant feeling tone and suddenly shift. And then often just a shifting can actually makes it us feel, oh, this is unpleasant. Often also by contrast. The next one. As long as an unpleasant feeling tone continues, it is unpleasant. When it stops, it can become pleasant. And that, I presume, we all have experienced it when you stop having a stomachache or having a headache. For a few days, you're so aware you don't have it. And because you don't have it, it's very pleasant. And then you forget you don't have it, and then it becomes neutral. But that moment when it stopped, you know, it's very nice. And they did some study that actually people prefer a short, sharp pain than a longer, less painful pain. And I think why is because of such the release. You have the little pain and it stops and you, I mean, once I was teaching a retreat, and I had toothache. But the toothache was very painful, but very short. So I would be sitting, and suddenly would, and then it would be gone. And it was very interesting because I did not know when it would happen. But luckily, it was very short, so it was kind of quite possible. Of course, I went to the dentist later on. Who fixed it? Then, the last one. If you understand neutral feeling tone, it becomes pleasant. If you don't understand neutral feeling tone, it becomes unpleasant. And this is where you can really see, like, neutral feeling tone, I would say nowadays, as a bad press. Like if you feel nothing is happening, then generally there is this very quick association with boredom. And personally, I think it's all because of the Romantics in the 18th century. It's all their fault. Because I read a little treatise against boredom by the Romantics. Very interesting. So, there is that, and there is also the fact that generally we like to be stimulated. As I said, my niece used to have an attack of boredom. And to me it's very interesting to see my niece. She might be revising her Spanish, and at the same time she will be listening to music and maybe watching TV. But that's the way it works. And if she just was revising her Spanish, it would not be fun. But with the music and the TV, then it's fine. So we have this kind of ambiguous, difficult relationship with neutral. So it can easily turn, you know, nothing is happening. It's boring. I am boring. Everybody thinks I am boring. It's awful. My life has no meaning. And I mean, you know, you can go to quite a painful place with that one. And so in a way to see, you know, what is our connection, our relationship with neutral feeling tone, because that can really, in a way, shift. And to me, that's what I discovered through the practice, is that neutral is good, actually, because nothing bad is happening. I mean, this is already something. Once I was teaching, and there was this lady who was saying she came from Poland to live in England, and she was very excited from Poland to come to England, and she actually came to London and found it very boring. You know, she had no friends, she did not know anybody, and it was very boring. And then she had a toothache, and she said, oh, then I realized boring was really nice compared to the toothache. But personally, I think if we see neutral as restful, and often neutral is seen as kind of like the ground for over time developing equanimity. It doesn't mean that we should always feel neutral. That's not what it says. But that neutral exists. And so how are we going to relate to it? But also I think one important teaching about neutral feeling tone is that over time with the practice, we come to realize that it's a baseline. Because often we have an assumption, an idea about our baseline. And often I feel people have the idea that the baseline is pleasant number five. But then if you have pleasant number five at the baseline, you only go up five and you go down 15. So that's a little problematic. But if the baseline is neutral, in a way you can go up 10, go down 10. There is more movement. So in a way, to be careful, what is my assumption of how I feel? But you could also have or feel a negative assumption or feel a very negative baseline. And I think that's what often happens with people who are depressed, is that actually the baseline goes down to -4. And then they kind of go down further, come back to -4, which is very unpleasant. And so is how can they bring the baseline up to neutral? So I think it can go both ways. And so in a way, to me, there is more possibility of balance, of equilibrium, if the baseline is neutral. So in a way, that's why I think the neutral can be quite interesting. And also, in our busy life, to see that we cannot always be activated with lots of things surrounding us. And that sometimes the whole body and mind complex has to rest. And then neutral is quite a nice place to be resting. So that in our daily life, if suddenly nothing is happening, possibly before checking Twitter or Facebook or something, can I just rest? And then of course I can engage with whatever. But I think another reason also for the feeling tone, personally, I see it as actually having a connection with ethics. That actually when we look at ethics and when we look at the precept, then we realize that actually a lot of the time the precepts are actually to help us to not be taken over by feeling tone. To me, that's why that's why it's so important to be aware of the feeling tones, because generally they make us very impulsive. And so we can have the feeling tone and then act often very impulsively. And often that can lead to harmful consequences for ourselves and for others. For example, if we look at the first precept, which is do not kill, do not harm. And of course, I presume none of you in this room kills anybody. But then we can, if we look at, I had a friend who used to work in jail. So he was a Buddhist chaplain and he used to go to jail. And he used to say the people, when he first came there, he thought the people were going to be really nasty, everything, but they were not nasty and everything. And he realized a lot of them, they were there because they could not control their reaction to their feeling tone. And so he had this young man, he was meeting that he was a very, normally a very nice person. But then, if somebody insulted him, then his feeling tone was so bad that he would go into a rage, he would fight. And then, unfortunately, one time he killed somebody. And so he ended up in jail. And I have another friend who is working in jail, and he does special workshop where he try to, in a way, diminish the intensity of the reaction for certain prisoner who react very fast and are kind of aggressive and violent. And one of the things he does is that the guy sits in a chair. So you have this kind of big guy sitting in a chair. And then my friend will insult him. And the fellow is supposed to not move, not do anything. And he says that over time, the fellow learned not first to react, but also to handle the feeling tone, to have a different relationship to the feeling tone. He hears the word, and instead of, in a way, grasping at it and amplifying and making it personal, oh, the guy said that. But this is not about me. And he said over time, he can diminish that effect or the reaction. So the feeling tone is less bad and then the reaction is less bad too. But then if we look in our daily life, what is interesting is what causes us to cause harm. I mean, generally we don't intend to cause harm. But if we just look at speech, you know, generally you try to have a friendly tone and use kind words. And sometimes you find yourself saying something with a mean tone and negative words. And look, why do you do this? A lot of the time is because of the feeling tone. You have this really unpleasant feeling tone, and it's like you have to, it impels you to speak in a nasty way. And to me, this is why it's so interesting to be aware of the feeling tone. Am I going to be taken over by it? And then generally the wisdom and the compassion go. Or am I aware of it and see how can I manage it? It's not saying you won't have the feeling tone, you have it. But how can you manage it? How can you engage with it? Once I was working with some people, and suddenly this fellow started to shout at me, like I was supposed to have an interview with him, like every week. And he said, I want to have an interview with you, and because you are like this, and I mean, you know, for 20 minutes, he shouted at me. And I just stood there. Because, I mean, it was not very pleasant. And at the same time, I could see it has nothing to do with me because I had not done any of the things he said I had done. So I just stood there. I had the unpleasant feeling tone, but I did not shout back or anything. When he finished, I said, well, you don't want to meet me. That's okay. You know? And then later he met me anyway, but what I saw is that if he could do this to me, then as he lived in community, he could do this to others. And then I got a friend of mine, and we went to see him, and we kind of sat him down and tried to find a way to make him understand that this is not on, you know, to shout at people in that way. But not on the moment, because I did not think it was much point to do it on the moment. So it's kind of, how can we experience unpleasant feeling tone? Notice, is they impel us to, in turn, in a way, be negative and harmful to others? And how can we engage in a different way? The next one, the next precept is, do not steal. And generally, what would you steal something? Because, if I get that, I mean, just seeing it, I get a pleasant feeling tone. And if I get it, I'm going to get an even better feeling tone. I mean, that generally, that's what stealing is about, is just this pleasant feeling tone. And I read this, this short thing in the paper one day. And it was about this young man who did not have any money, but they wanted to go on holiday. So thinking about holiday gave them a pleasant feeling tone, and so they wanted to go on holiday. But they did not have any money, so they decided to rob one of the van. You know, the van who goes around getting money to the bank and things like that? And so they tried to rob one of these van, armored van. But what they chose to rob it with was unsuccessful, because they did not have guns or things like that, so it was... it failed, and then they ended up in jail. But it shows, this, if only we could go on holiday, and then finding a way which is not very appropriate or successful to do it. But to see us, to see how we tempted, very tempted by this. And of course we don't try to rob an armored van, but sometimes we see something we like and we think, they won't miss it. They have so many things, they won't miss it. You often do this with books. Oh, they're not reading it properly. You know, I will take better care of it. And this is just because of the feeling tone. I remember when I was young, when I was in my 18, I lived in England. And one of the things I did was I would go to spiritual bookshop and I would liberate books. Meaning, basically, I would steal them. And then after doing this a few times and reading them, I thought it was a little not congruent, you know, to steal spiritual books and reading their message. And my solution to this was actually, I realized that if I went to the bookshop, I would see the book and I would be, I want this pleasant feeling tone, spiritual pleasant feeling tone. And so my solution was not to go to the bookstore anymore. So I stopped. Then you have the next one. And the next one is, the precepts is, do not cause harm through sexuality. And it's the same. It's saying that, you know, sexuality generally pleasant feeling talk. So generally, I want to have lots of it and more of it. And sometimes it's regardless of what the other person thinks. And so it's kind of seeing, am I forgetting the other person because I'm lost in my good feeling tone? This is, I think, something to look a little at. Not meaning you should not enjoy it, if you can have it, but to look, how am I with that feeling tone? Do I consider the feeling tone of the other person to the same degree? I think that's an interesting one there. Then you have lying. The precept is, do not lie. And then it's a good question. Why do we lie? And actually, we might lie either because of a pleasant feeling tone, and we lie in order to get something good, or we might lie because of an unpleasant feeling torn. You know, when you have young children and they break something, and I mean, it's there, and they say, I did not do it. It's very interesting because they feel really bad. And so they kind of, no, no, I did not do it, when obviously they did it. And we also do that, even later on. And so, in a way, just to see, if I don't really tell the truth, what is it about? What is the feeling to? It doesn't mean that we should tell the truth all the time to the same degree. Because I think appropriate speech, we have to be careful what is also appropriate to tell the person. And so personally, that's one big thing I try to do, is not to lie. But if somebody asks me a difficult question, then generally I will say, no comment. And then you have the last one. And the last one is not to drink alcohol or not to take intoxicant. And again, the idea is so that if you take it to a certain degree, it will amper, it will stop your wisdom, or will stop your compassion. I mean, the famous example, it's like a little legendary example about that one, is that you have a fellow, he's walking down the road at the time of the Buddha, and he kind of is very tired, very thirsty, and there is this little place where you can get drinks, and he asks for some water, and actually instead he drinks a full thing of alcohol. And then because he gets totally drunk, he goes and kills the chicken to eat the food, then he has sex with the wife of the person, and he lies about it. So by being drunk, he kind of breaks all the precepts. So it's kind of, but then it's very interesting to look at. Why do I need to drink? Why do I need to take drugs? And often it's again, either one. Either I feel so bad that I need to drink to feel better. So then it's in reaction to an unpleasant feeling tone. Or it's in reaction to, oh, if I have this drink, then I will have this fantastic feeling tone. If I have this drug, I feel so fantastic. And I'm following this charity in England who works with prisoners in prison. And they teach yoga and meditation. And so there are little newsletters. And so the people, they get letters from the prisoners they help. And so there was this fellow who was in jail for drugs. And then he got out of jail but learned meditation there. And he said, I realized doing the meditation that what I liked was the high of the drugs. But I realized it was not very helpful for many different reasons. So he decided I need to find a legal high. Something which gives me the same pleasant sensation, but which is not kind of getting me into trouble. So he went to Australia and took up surfing. That's a solution. So to me, in terms of ethics, is to see that generally our intention is to be kind, wise, and compassionate. And so it's not rule and regulation, but it's more, in a way, what are the conditions that helps me to be kind and compassionate? And what are the conditions that stop me? And then to see what is our relationship. Are we reacting, being taken over by the power of the feeling tones? Or are we creatively engaging? And I would say if we creatively engage with the feeling tones, actually naturally, will be more likely to be ethical. And so the last thing I wanted to talk about was to see that we can be aware of the feeling tones. That's a contact with the senses. But then another thing we can be aware of is feeling sensation. So here I'm not talking technically Buddhist. Here I'm just talking from my experience. So, because there are feeling tones and different things, and then generally we react to it in different way, and then generally we have this more, like I would say, emotional sensation. And generally, this emotion, this sensation, we actually experience it in the body. It's not like it's floating. Sadness, anger, whatever, happiness, it doesn't float here. We experience it. And we experience it in the body. And so generally there is a place, maybe in the heart, maybe in the belly. Once somebody was telling me he experienced it in the back of his neck. And so you feel something. And generally, very quickly, you're going to name it. This is sadness, this is anger, this is that. And generally, you're going to associate different things to it. And I think one meditation which can be useful, if you can, is to just, instead of going into the naming and the storying, in the experience itself. How does it feel? How does it feel here? Before I name it, is it heavy? Is it agitated? Is it a little moving? Is it changing? And I think if we do this, we are in a way less, there'll be less amplification. It doesn't mean we are not going to experience emotion, because generally if there is condition, then this feeling sensation becomes an emotion. And then it's very likely that the emotion can become a disturbing emotion. But I think it's important to see that emotions, like thought, are creative functions. They're creative function of the organism. That it be sadness, anger, fear, happiness, joy, they're all functions. So when we do meditation, we're not trying to stop anger or fear, sadness or whatever, or happiness. But I think what we're trying to help is with the movement from emotion to disturbing emotion. Because when the emotion becomes disturbed, then generally we are overwhelmed. And so let's look a little in looking at it. So let's take fear. Fear is a survival mechanism. This is very important to have fear. And because fear is actually going to help us to maintain most of the time the integrity of this body-mind complex. So fear is very useful. But is it like kind of like a real fear? Because something is dangerous right now. When my niece was younger, in the summer, we used to go and do zip line. Do you know zip line? Okay, you have a line, you attach yourself to it, and then you zip among the tree. You know, you might be like 3 meters or 10 meters. You've not done this kind of thing. Oh, you don't have them in Finland. Okay. So anyway, you have these things in France where you kind of, you know, climb up trees and you go through the zip line and all that. And one of the things my niece wanted to do, and she was 11, 12 years old, was to do the Tarzan jump. Because that jump, you only could do it once you were 12. So once she was got 12, she absolutely wanted to do it. And then what you do is you climb up one platform and you're attached and you throw yourself in the emptiness and you get into a net. Then you climb the net, then you go to the next platform, which is much higher, throw yourself into the net and climb to the last platform, which is really high. So we go to the first one, fine. We go to the second one, fine. We go to the third one, it's like, and my mind know it's safe. But my body is saying, no way, I'm not doing this. So, for her to do it, I have to do it. So I throw myself in the thing, I climb the net, and I get to the platform, and I'm... And my mind was okay, but my body really was saying, this was dangerous. And what is interesting is that 2 weeks later, we did it again. And then, when I threw myself, same effect. But when I arrived in the platform, there was not the, no trembling anymore. Like my body integrated, this is not dangerous, never mind, you know. We can do this. So, this is fear. Fear is to kind of like tell you, this is dangerous. But then, to me, the question is a good question to ask. I feel fear. Am I in danger or not? And that's back to safety. Am I safe or not? And when I was in Korea, once a year, we used to do a non-sleep week. So for a week, you don't sleep and you sit all day long and all night long. And I did not mind the sitting. That's not the problem. The problem was that in the middle of the night, I would have to go to the bathroom outside and it would be very dark. And then I would be so afraid. And so I went to the master and I said, you know, I'm so afraid, what can I do? And he said to me, go back to your question. Well, that's what you do there. You ask, what is this? What is this? Go back to your question. And I thought the question would be magical. Like it would be protect me from the bad guys out there. So I would go out at night and I would say, what is it? What is it? What is it? I'd go to the bathroom. And then it worked. But then I saw how it worked. Because I would go out in the night and I would feel there is a guy out there with a knife. He's going to get me. But with the what is this, I realized who would know? I would be here and they would come and get me anyway. I am in the middle of nowhere. And what I realized is that it was not magic, but it brought me back to the reality. What is the reality now? And we have to see that a lot of the time, fear, the fear we have is not the fear of now. The fear we have is of the future. And the problem is with amplification. You're afraid in the abstract of something. And so it can get really, really big. But you can't do anything because your creative potential cannot do anything in the abstract. I had a friend, he was very afraid. If this happened, my life will be finished. For 30 years. And then one day I see him and he looks really strange. And I say, what happened? He said, well, you know, the thing I feared for 30 years happened and I am fine. But he was fine because in the experience of it, he could creatively engage with it. There is a wonderful film, I don't know if you've seen it, I saw it idly watching TV, and it's called Dinotopia. It's about dinosaur and people, but this film has the best quote I have ever seen in a film. So you have, you know, young people who are training and they have to show their courage. And they have to jump over a huge chasm. So you have, you know, 15 people and then the girls, the boys, they jump, they jump, they jump. And our hero comes and he's like, and then the instructor says to the boy, fear is in the future, jump now. So in a way, we fear, I think it's to see, how can I know it? How can I manage it? And so it's kind of see, what is it that release it a little bit, what is it that increase it? Then the other one is anger. Anger is a creative function. I know in the Buddhist circle, anger has really a bad press. You're not supposed to be angry, but then you become resentful. You know, personally, I think it's better to be angry than resentful. At least it's more obvious. But anger is a creative function. The function of anger is to make us act, is to give us energy. And so it has this very good function. I mean, once I was at a peace conference, and it was like, I was feeling more and more neutral, because everybody was being very peaceful and talking about peace, and it was... And then this guy come up, you know, little guy, is one of my heroes. He came up, l'abbé Pierre, he came up on the stage and he said, "I am angry." And I said, "Ah, that one is interesting." And he said, "I am angry at poverty. I am angry at homelessness." And that anger made him act. I mean, in the 50s, he was a person who really changed things for homeless people in France. Even become an MP in parliament in order to change things. So he was angry, but you could say it was a healthy, positive anger, where he did not become aggressive, but he became active. But for us, to see when we are angry, often what happens is that it can become explosive. So we become angry and generally we lose it. We lose wisdom, we lose compassion. And so the question is, but what can I do if I have this anger, if I am angry? What can I do? And with any emotions, I think the thing is in a way to become aware of it, to really not repress it, but to become really aware of how does it feel? How does it feel in the body? How does it feel in the mind? I mean, I am a little kind of, I'm more the angry type than the passive type. And so, you know, I used to get angry and things of that nature. And then it got a little better, you know, as I got more meditation, it got a little better. But still. And then one day, I was having a discussion with another Buddhist. So it was, you know, one of these discussions where you don't raise a voice, but lots of energy. And she would say, "You never do it." And I would say, "No, I was only one time, but I'll do it." "No, no, you never do it, so." And then I had to stop the conversation because I was cooking, like the manager here, for a conference. And so I had to prepare my meal, so I left the conversation. And so I was, you know, cutting carrots. And then suddenly, I saw myself cutting carrots. And I thought, "Ooh, wait a minute, this is a little dangerous." Then I thought, "What is going on?" And so I went inside the body, and my body was shaking. And then I realized, I am doing this to my body. Nobody else is doing that. And just seeing that, it just went. And then I looked into the mind. And the mind was saying, "I am right, she is wrong. I am right, she is wrong." And then I realized she must be thinking the same, but the opposite way. And I realize we are both right and wrong. So I think it's important not to be, in a way, afraid of our emotion. Afraid of the amplifying of the emotion, yes. But trying to see, when I am afraid, how does it feel? What happens in the body, in the mind? When I'm angry, what happens in the body, in the mind? And I think what we'll see is that the meditation is not going to stop us being afraid or being angry or being sad. But what it can diminish is the intensity and also the length. I remember when I was young, like, you know, 10 years old, I could be angry for a week. You know, and then I started to meditate, angry for a day. And then now I can be angry for a very short period. And very kind of, just it comes, I see it, and I leave it. A recent one was fun. I'm cooking this mango mousse. Delicious mango mousse. So I mix it. Then, you know, I scoop it and there is a little bit left. So I need to scoop it with a better scoop, like really to get every last single drop of this delicious mango mousse. So I leave it here. But my husband is also helping me to do the dishes as we do that. And I go there to get the spatula. And I come back and it's washed. And I'm like, and it lasted 5 seconds. And then we kind of laughed. But you could have this feeling, and then you could say, you always do this, and da-da-da-da, and you could have, you know, a big scène de ménage. So I think that's what we have to see, that it's human to feel sad, to feel frustrated, to feel fearful. But in a way, how identified are we with it? How much do we amplify or not? I think this is really what the meditation, what the awareness is going to help us with. So.